second session, just as a tribute to Veterans Day, I've chosen a recipient that he didn't die in his action, but he had passed away before I ever had the chance to meet him. But I would have loved to met this guy. And this one comes to us from World War II. And I got a lot of juices now flowing about that because I'm addicted to this program, Combat. And it's the old black and whites from the 1960s. I used to watch those things with Sergeant Saunders and Lieutenant Hanley and all those guys. And then I'd go out and I'd reenact them all with my action figures, with my G.I. Joes. And I even had some I'd dress up as Germans and all that kind of thing. And I never realized, though, that Vic Morrow wound up getting his head cut off. He was in that chopper accident. And I never knew his daughter was, what is her name? I'm not going to be able to, but she's an actress. If you ever saw the movie, it was a Backdraft. She was the main lady in that. What was her name? This reminds me of Sergeant Saunders. But this is the citation of a technical sergeant in the United States Army by the name of Bernard P. Bell. Bernard Bell. And it's a very... Another thing you realize is that I can pick up very, very clearly that, you know, there's... The Army, the military will actually find people who are good at writing citations. And whoever wrote this one does not write it like the other citations. And it's a little bit more fun to read in that way. But it's a marvelous account of this technical sergeant. He was in Company I in the 142nd Infantry in the 36th Infantry Division. And the place and date for this was Middleware, France, on about 18 December 1944. But this actually occurred over several days. It says, for conspicuous fighting gallantry at Middleware, France, on the morning of 18 December 1944, he led a squad against a schoolhouse held by enemy troops. These would be Germans. While his men covered him, he dashed toward the building, surprised two guards at the door, and took them prisoner without firing a shot. He found that other Germans were in the cellar. These he threatened with hand grenades, forcing 26 in all to emerge and surrender. His squad then occupied the building and prepared to defend it against powerful enemy action. The next day, the enemy poured artillery and mortar barrages into the position, disrupting communications, which Sergeant Bell repeatedly repaired under heavy small arms fire as he crossed dangerous terrain to keep his company commander informed of his squad's situation. During the day, several prisoners were taken and other Germans killed when hostile forces were attracted to the schoolhouse by the sound of captured German weapons fired by the Americans. At dawn the next day, the enemy prepared to assault the building. A German tank fired round after round into the structure, partially demolishing the upper stories. Despite this heavy fire, Sergeant Bell climbed to the second floor and directed artillery fire, which forced the hostile tank to withdraw. He then adjusted mortar fire on large forces of enemy foot soldiers attempting to reach the American position. And when this force broke and attempted to retire, he directed deadly machine gun fire and rifle fire into the disorganized ranks. Calling for armored support to blast out the German troops hidden behind the wall, he unhesitatingly exposed himself to enemy small arms fire to stand beside a friendly tank and tell its occupants where to rip holes in the walls. You see, you don't get rip holes in the new citations. Where to rip holes in the walls, protecting approaches to the school building. By the way, this is how a battle ought to be reported. Notice there's nothing in here about how many of our guys were killed. It's not like what you get at the end of the news broadcast today about, well, we lost two or three soldiers today. You never get to tell how many enemy we killed. And so this was from another day and time when you weren't trying to color people's thinking. But he says, he then trained machine guns on the gaps and mowed down. There's another word you don't find in most of these citations. He ripped holes and mowed them down. So whoever the guy was that wrote this, this is the guy I'd want writing my citation if I ever had one. And he mowed down all the hostile troops attempting to cross the open to get closer to the school building. By his intrepidity and bold, aggressive leadership, Sergeant Bell enabled his eight-man squad. This is a squad, eight men, an eight-man squad. And this is the kind of report we ought to get at the end of our news broadcast today. This eight-man squad to drive back approximately 150 of the enemy, killing at least 87, capturing 42. Personally, this is the last line of his citation, personally, he killed more than 20 and captured 33 prisoners. Now, there's a guy. I don't know what it cost to train that young man, but they got every dime of it back in that one action alone. So it's men like that that we have our freedom today. All right, let's get back to our study at hand of understanding and appreciating our sonship education and moving on to this next thing. By the way, I just wanted to... I come across these things from time to time, and I don't know if they're certainly probably not edifying, but just to bring it out, I care a lot about music. You all know that. I'm a musician, and I think I proved a few weeks ago that I can play a little bit. The hymns, the older hymns, especially the ones that date back quite a long time, were when they were written by people who had a grasp of the English language and was able to communicate more than, "You're worthy, you're worthy, you're worthy." Holy Moses. You know, if I was God, I'd be up there like that. But in the 18th century, around the middle of the 18th century, which for some of you, that's the 1700s, oddly enough, a fellow by the name of Robert Robinson wrote the words to what I consider one of the greatest hymns that has ever been written. I'd like to get to the point where we could sing this here, because even the music to it is really wonderful as well. You know this hymn, but you know it because I play it almost all the time, and it's called "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing." But the words to that, whoever wrote this Robinson fella, has got to have had knowledge of what you and I are talking about in sonship education. Some of the things, it's amazing what some of these people... You know, it's not that we are the only ones that have ever known about sonship education and edification. Others have known about it. You just don't hear about them very much. And I just wanted to read the words to some of this so that you get a feeling for that. And it starts out, "Come thou fount of every blessing." By the way, it's not "come thou fount of many blessings." It's "come thou fount of every blessing." That's even consistent with Paul in Ephesians, us being blessed with all spiritual blessings in the heavenly places. But the beauty of this and the cadence to this and the choice of words are very telling to the insight of this man's understanding of his spiritual life. "Come thou fount of every blessing, tune my heart." See, the whole thing is my heart has to be dealt with by my Father. "Tune my heart to sing thy grace. Streams of mercy never ceasing call for songs of loudest praise. Teach me some melodious melody sung by flaming tongues above. Praise the mount." And when I first heard that, I thought, uh-oh, that's Mount Sinai, we're going under the law. And by the way, they changed those words in the newer version of this. He says, "Praise the mount, I'm fixed upon it, mount of thy redeeming love." It's Mount Calvary that he's talking about. The second stanza says, "Here I raise mine..." And again, "I raise mine," we would never say, "I raise my," and it's the beautiful older English, "I raise mine Ebenezer." Do you even know what an Ebenezer is? "I raise mine Ebenezer." Haven't been reading your Bible. Solomon raised up a stone and carved upon it. It was set as a stone of memorial where God was his help. And that's one of the main things that God was trying to instruct Israel in, as into his Jehovahness and grace. "I'll be your help. Don't look to the nations, the Gentiles, as your help. I'll be your help. And here I raise mine Ebenezer is setting, it's the way that Samuel set that stone of help up, where it commemorated God's help. He says, here I raise mine Ebenezer, hitherto thy help I'm come, and I hope by thy good pleasure safely to arrive at home. It's and in the heavenly places. Jesus sought me when a stranger, wandering from the fold of God, he to rescue me from danger interposed his precious blood. Just interposed it. He put it between me and the wrath that I deserved. The last stanza says, oh, and this is, I think, one of the greatest of them all, oh, to grace, how great a debtor. Daily I'm constrained to be. That's what this is doing. It's constraining me. When you're constrained, you're gripped by it. It's come to grip you. And he says, oh, to grace, how great a debtor, daily I'm constrained to be. Let thy goodness, like a fetter, bind my wandering heart to thee. It's a heart issue. And listen to this, the beauty of this. He says, prone to wander. That's what all of these proverbial exhortations are telling the son. I know you naturally want to wander away from this education. Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. And the last words of this are just so beautiful. Here's my heart. O take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above. Courts. That's rulership. This guy that wrote this knew what I just illustrated to you last lesson. He knew about this. And this was written in 1757. Well, anyway, this is exciting stuff to me. Let's take a look now as we are having our attitude now adjusted to match the Father's, knowing wisdom and instruction. The next thing the Father's going to do is cause the Son to perceive words of understanding. Let's try to move along in this a little bit this morning. So, the first infinitive there being to know the words of wisdom and instruction, in the sense of becoming aware, as I said, of the value and importance and the worth of the Father's wisdom and instruction, as well as the fact that, as you're told in the exhortation that follows it, there's only two ways or paths that son can take. And the son becomes aware that following this competing wisdom, and you're going to be always slammed with this, with competing wisdom all the time. I mean, it gets to the point where even on television, I can't even watch NBC anymore because they want to paint me green for some reason. And so it's just so nauseating that it's thank God for DVD players and combat. So I watched a lot of combat, Andy Griffith, and you know. So anyway, but what I'm after is that all of that wisdom forms another path and another way, and there's only two of these. There's this competing wisdom that you're always going to have to face. And it's enticing, and it has allurements to it. But it's not what the Father esteems. It's a path that is not the Father's, and if the Son follows that, it means that Son is just what the Father says here: you are a fool in my eyes. And that means that Son despises the Father's wisdom and instruction. And the attitude, first and foremost, there in that first issue or first part of knowing wisdom and instruction, is the desire that's set within the Son to not be a fool in his Father's eyes. To not be a fool and to properly receive the wisdom and instruction of his Father. And the Son will know by means of the exhortation to know wisdom and instruction, that by doing so, when I'm doing that, I'm qualifying myself to function. As we said before, I don't have time to go back to it, but with all of that in the heavenly places, I'm qualifying myself to function in positions of intelligent responsibility in my Father's business. It's my vocational training, and that's what all of that is. And I don't mean this in this snobbish way that it's used. I mean to use this term in the way that it should be properly understood, the word intelligentsia. And that's what we will be as sons in the heavenly places. We will be a son placed with intelligence. He knows what... It's like reading that verse in Romans 8:28, for all things work together. I've had people, they pop that like an aspirin. They take it like a spiritual pill. And they have no idea the context within which that is sitting or the mechanical means by which that is designed to properly and effectually work. And it's not just quoting it that makes that true. It's not having it on a bumper sticker that makes it true. It's understanding it as a son where it occurs in the curriculum and what it's designed to do. It's having understanding about it. And I could go into a lot of examples, but for right now, we're going to let that go. But it's always the son realizing I'm going to be put in a position of intelligent responsibility. My father can say, take that to him. Take that to Mark Johnson. He knows what to do with it. Take that to Steve Young. He'll know what to do with it. Take that problem to Amanda Newbold, she'll know what to do with it. Take that problem and or take that situation, whatever this structure that God has designed, that's what, how He's designed it for you to be there and to know. But as you get there, upon arrival, you'll know what to do. And you'll have that education and be involved in that business. And that's why down there, let your eye come down there to verse 9. He says that this wisdom and instruction shall be an ornament of grace unto thy head and chains about thy neck. That's promotion. Chains on the neck, that's promotion in business. And knowing the value and worth of the Father's instruction implies, it implies, look, I don't know how to do this. I value your instruction. You know how to do this. And if I'm ever going to succeed in this business, you're going to have to teach me this or I'll fail. That's knowing that instruction. And all that adds to the sum of it is, are you going to do this or not? Are you going to enroll in this education or not? Do you value it or not? Is there something else you value more important than this or not? It's real simple. And he draws very distinct lines in it. You have this path or the path of the wisdom of this world. You follow that, you're a fool to me. You can impress others. You can go to church every Sunday. You can be the Sunday school superintendent. You can even be a pastor and be following, but you're a fool to me. Your church may be thousands and mega whatever, but you're a fool to me. And what you've been taught from Romans 1:1 to Romans 8:13 means that you have a healthy respect for what is called the fear of the Lord. What your father thinks should matter by now. And all that God has made you to be in Christ has brought that about in you and generated that in you. So it should smart, it should matter what he thinks and what he likes and what he doesn't. If not, you haven't gotten something between Romans 1:1 and 8:13. Down properly, if it just doesn't matter to you. But you have to understand that God your Father will not educate you against your will. It's one of the reasons why we began this morning by going back there to Romans 8:14 and 15, so that you realize that you are going to be as many as are led by the Spirit of God. They are the sons of God. This is the Apostle Paul's one verse, condensed definition of what a son is. A son is led by the Spirit of God. For as many as are led by the Spirit of God, they are the sons of God. And that tells you this isn't something I'm being forced to do. Because it's as many as. That's not everybody. It could be. But as many as tells you it's just the ones who submit to this. It's the ones who want this. As many as are led by the Spirit of God. And you know that when you properly define, as we will talk about it in detail when we get back there, what it means to be led by the Spirit of God in verse 14, which is, it's such an abused expression today. I mean, it's unbelievable what people, well, not unbelievable, but it's just, it's a tragic the way this expression is abused in Christianity today. Because it's commonly thought of or commonly meant when this is preached or taught, that it means to say that this is some sort of spectacular, strange, supernatural phenomenon of guiding your life through heart feelings. I just get this heart feeling. It's kind of spiritual ET, you know. My heart glows, then I should do this. type thing. And that's the way this is taught. I mean, as crass as that, but that's the end result of it, that supposedly the Holy Spirit is going to, he's got this like poker, and he's just going to jab you. I just got jabbed. I was going through the line and paying for my donuts, and oh, I got jabbed to go over here, and I'm going to talk to you about Jesus. Because I was led by the Spirit. Look, I don't like getting jabbed. And not only that, I don't want somebody who's got jabbed to come talk to me. Keep it to yourself. I know when somebody taps me, and I've had them do it, because especially when they find out you're a minister. And they'll grab your hands, and they'll start and they'll say, God spoke to me to say this to you. And I'm like, get me out of here. You know, I just want to run the other way as fast as I can. I had a lady once in my church in Indiana. And she came, and I didn't know it, but she was a Pentecostal to the core. And she came up after class, and I happened to teach a sermon that day that wasn't on Pentecostal anything. And she was thrilled with it. She was going to dedicate to something. And she got me at the back of the church, and she said, Brother Mark, she said, can I pray for you? And I thought, well, heavens, anybody can pray for me. I need all the prayer I can get. I said, sure. And before I could even get sure out, she grabbed my hands and jerked me down, and she said, oh, God, I just pray this over this young man. And she's praying stuff all over me now. And I'm like Harry Ironside, you know. I'm just praying she'll shut up, and I want to go home and eat lunch. But this is the kind of thing that runs rampant in many Christian circles today, that there's some kind of prodding or prompting or jabbing that is done by the Spirit to do certain things and not do certain things. He gives you good feelings and bad feelings, and that's how he leads you. Like a spiritual divining rod, you know, it just kind of, and okay, I got to go over there. I go over there, you know, type thing. Pardon the sound effects, but I have to get Eric back there with real sound effects going on. But that's the way the Holy Spirit's leading is usually thought of. That's not even close to the, by the time you get to verse 14, you'll know with some intelligence what the leading of the Spirit is about here. And when we deal with that biblically and define that expression the way it's supposed to be defined, it's the Spirit of God leading you through words, exact words on the page of a book. This book, the one God wrote, the one he was in charge of overseeing. And he's going to lead you through the words of this doctrinal curriculum that God has for you as his son. We can talk about that more, but you need to recognize that, and we will when we get back there, but you've got to recognize the Spirit, my point is not going to lead you against your will. You can stop this any moment, any time. And God isn't going to make your life worse. You know, people got this impression, even from me, from my first years pastoring here, that if you ever break away from this assembly, your life is just going to go down the toilet. That's not true. Your Heavenly Father's dealing with you as an adult. There are people who've left this assembly who are doing fine. They're a spiritual wreck, but in every other way, they're doing fine. God hasn't struck them dead. He didn't flatten their tires. Some of them are making more money now than they ever made in their life. In many ways, their life, you know, physically and those are better off than they ever were. No, the place you pay for this is going to be at the judgment seat of Christ. Not now. The place where this gets settled is there. And as an adult, your father will let you go. And he's not going to grab you by the collar and kicking and screaming through this whole thing. That's not what this education is designed to do. You've got to want it. And so I'm just saying this again to you so that you realize that you're not being forced into something here. In fact, if you would rather just study the Bible for study's sake, fire me, get a different pastor in here, and you can learn little Bible lessons just to study for study's sake. Well, we're going to study the Sermon on the Mount because, I don't know, we just haven't looked at it in a while. Do you know that most churches, most pastors who stand in pulpits have no idea why they're teaching? What? In fact, a lot of them are following, this is something some of you don't even know exists. Have you ever heard of a pastor's annual? Yeah, you buy them all. Have you ever wondered why, if you, when you hear on the radio and TV a Baptist preacher and then maybe a local one, that their sermons almost match? They're following a pastor's annual that has their whole sermons written out for them, every sermon for every week of the year. You can buy them. Dirty little secret. And some of them have no idea why they're studying the book of Psalms. Well, it's in the Bible. Well, that's ridiculous. In fact, some of that can even be counterproductive. I know why I'm in Romans, because I know what Romans is. It's the very first book of the curriculum for my sonship education. And the one that follows that is the next thing I need to know. It's just an example of showing you that there's structure to this and design beyond anything you can imagine built into the Word of God. And the Spirit is going to lead you not against your will, not dragging you kicking and screaming through the curriculum, imparting wisdom and instruction and understanding and so forth and producing against your will, becoming a wise man and a man of understanding. Wrong. No. Your father's going to say, you want to be a fool? Be one. Be all you can be. You've joined the fool's army. Go, man, go. We're adults here. I'm holding out to you the prospect of what I'm offering. If it's of no value to you, I'll see you later. You'll be left to a fool, being a fool in your father's eyes. The Spirit will be in you as a Christian. He's given to you at the moment of salvation for sure, but the Spirit of, and he's given as the Spirit of adoption. Yet he will not be able to produce in you any godly thinking whatsoever if you resist it. And not only will you have to determine and decide volitionally to enroll in the education, but you also have to recognize, as we read through, why I read through Romans there a little bit, there is an opposition to this. Someone out there wants to resist this at all cost. Why do you think so few Christians today have ever heard about sonship education and edification? The way that God writes it. Well, you have to recognize Satan and his policy of evil has a vicious determination to see to it that you never enroll in your father's school of wisdom. And he has ways and means called by the Apostle Paul wiles of seeing to it that you never want to attend class. You won't incline your ear. You won't apply your heart. You simply won't give any time to this education. And you already have a willing nemesis or an ally within you that he can join up with, so to speak. He's got your own nature of sin still resident and remaining in you that he can make appeals to you and speak, you know, make these offers to and put pressure on. And we have a whole system of culture that's designed to pressure that. You got to do this and you got to do that. Oh my gosh, I haven't got, you know, I've got to worm my dog. I've got to do this. I've got to do that. I've got every minute of every day accounted for by something the world tells me is important. You're not seeding your lawn now? No. If I could, I'd kill it. I like Katie's idea. Just throw pine straw over everything and never mow it. There's the way to go. Only I'd like it colored green. They come out with green pine straw, count me in. I don't mind walking across my yard and it crunching under my feet. I'm saying, I don't have to mow you. I don't have to mow you. Yeah, but the pressure and the way especially American culture today is designed, it tells you how to have leisure, how to spend your time, how to have fun. If you're not doing this, you're not having fun. People think I'm nuts because I like to go up to the Shenandoah Valley and do nothing. Sit there and look at trees. But I'm looking at trees on a battlefield. And I know who's marched through there. And, you know, it has meaning to me. But all I'm after is that we have a whole system that's designed to aid this adversary's policy of evil. And with that nature of sin that's still within me, It can pressure and entice and allure to keep you and me from ever honestly enrolling and honestly attending the classes that are necessary, and then spending time with your Father in real, intelligent sonship prayer, where you're not going through a mantra of, I got to do this and this and this, and you make a mental checklist of going through your prayer like that, got it all done, wrap it up, amen, and go on. But where you sit down and you say, Father, this is great. I mean, just something that simple. Because he's like right in your face. He's like, what did you learn today? This is so great. And you can almost anticipate him saying, well, tell me, how is it great? You've got this I am a body and I've got this plan, I've got this prayer and all that. And it just thrills him to hear that. Or to say, Father, I absolutely am struggling with this and I don't understand this. I know you've given me your Spirit and are attempting to lead me by that Spirit, but I'm really not understanding this well. Let him know that. Talk to him like you'd talk to a father, not like you're a creature talking to a God. Because my understanding is, even though he is omnipotent and omniscient and omnipresent, he has structured this as a two-way relationship. I mean this, and we'll see this as we go on, where when you say, do you know what I learned today? He can say, no, I don't, and mean it. What value is it to sit down and talk to God who knows everything I'm going to say and think and do before I ever do it? You say, well, God, how could he do that? Look at Jesus Christ. He limited himself to the form of a man. And he can certainly do that with you. As your Father, say, tell me what you learned, because I don't know. And it's real. I mean, it's a real relationship, two-way. But we'll get into that as we get into the education more. But those are some of the things it holds out to you. And so you spend time with your Father discussing what he's been teaching you through his words. And really, that's where most saints find themselves today. They find themselves in that foolish category, fools in their Father's eyes who despise wisdom and instruction. They're going to church, they're going through the ritual, they're even studying the Bible, but they're studying it for study's sake. They're not studying it for any real value of its curriculum. Just to get a little gem here and a little gem there and maybe put a bumper sticker on. But you got to realize you're treading down a path that is not worn down at all. The path that we're treading down, not very many Christians have ever gone. It's not very well worn. It doesn't have many footprints on it at all. And I'm saying all this, and again, I know it's review, and I know that. But it's just to underscore the fact that all of the first phase of level one, all of that first phase is again to educate us as sons and has to deal a lot with the issue of our attitude and our desire and willingness to undergo this. And to do that, it's incumbent upon the Father now to make the Son aware of some things. To now make him aware of some things that is going to really make his jaw hit the ground. It's like, all right, you've seen some things about my business, but now let me take you and show you something about it that you maybe have never thought about before, how you're going to function in it. And he's going to do something with the Son at this point that's really where what we looked at in Romans 8 this morning, that's where that comes in. Really, from Romans 8:16 to the end of the chapter, he's going to cause you to perceive words of understanding. And he's going to do something and set something before you, almost like dangling that carrot, that's going to greatly impress you. And it's going to impress you to such a high degree that it's going to be able to fight through many of the lulls and the dreariness and even some of the boredom. Do you know that in the book of Proverbs, it has built into the curriculum areas where the teacher is able to come along and say, all right, Solomon got bored here. So I know, and there's a great passage where he says, go to the ant, thou sluggard. I love that passage. And that's David telling Solomon, go look at the ant. I know that at this point in the curriculum, your tendency is to become bored. But go to the ant, thou sluggard. And he starts talking to him about an ant. How that ant doesn't have to be watched all the time. He's going to go out and he's going to forage. He's going to get food. He's going to bring it back to the colony. He's going to do all of these things. And he doesn't have to have a father as a taskmaster watching him over his shoulder every step of the way. When you start to become a sluggard, that's boredom begins to set in. There's doctrine that's even designed to carry you through that, and exhortations, and as a teacher of the doctrine, I've got to know when that's going to occur so that I can encourage and exhort you at that time to not become bored with this and leave it and become a fool, but to stay with it. All of that is marvelously built into this. So that's why I'm taking the pains of going back over things. So with that said, anyway, the whole refresher course that we just had in first session, and now the second, I've got 5 minutes left to get on with what I want to say. We should now expect to find that the next two infinitives should still be along these lines. It shouldn't run afoul of this hardly at all, or depart much from the overall setting of the son's attitude to properly receive his education from his father. But at the same time, it should build. It should take a step beyond or advance the issue further. And so we have to know wisdom and instruction to perceive the words of understanding. The next infinitive in the remainder of verse 2 that builds on the first one and rounds out and fills up the first phase of level 1, sonship education, is very much, first of all, like that first part, to know. And it's to perceive. Perception. Perceive is also a word that's used to indicate the acquiring of an awareness and a recognition. And it's somewhat very similar to the word know, but it's not exactly like it. And we want to see the distinguishing, discriminating difference because, as you already know, it's the shade of meaning that perceive has that causes us to see it as a step beyond just simply to know wisdom and instruction. Just to know the value of the Father's wisdom and his education he wants to give me, I'm now to perceive that there are words out there that are words of understanding. And this is the marvelous thing about it, that you gain understanding. I've used some illustrations. There's many that we could look at, and it's the difference between coming along and saying, I'm trying to just think of one off the top of my head. Take the issue of, let me put the timeline chart up there. Take the issue in the gospel accounts when Jesus teaches all of his parables. You have the parable of the seed and the sower, especially there in Matthew. He teaches 7 different parables. It's the difference between looking at those parables as cute little stories that were, they're kind of like Aesop's fables or some wisdom pearls from Plato or something like that. And it's even the difference between being able to teach them with some kind of intelligence biblically. But as we looked at those things, we recognize that those 7 parables are in a particular order. And those 7 parables are going to be taught and utilized by the remnant out here in the final installment of the Lord's Day of Wrath. And they're going to run. The first one is going to be set into motion at the very beginning, and the second one, they run in pairs. And then there's a point at the midway point in this day of wrath when when Satan will set up I can't think of the entire expression of it now, but the what? The abomination of desolation gets established and set up there in the temple. From then on, then there's going to be those other parables that start working there. What I'm after is that when you understand the parables generally, that's some measure of wisdom. When you understand them within the framework of God's program with Israel, where they all kick in and what they're all designed to do, now you understand them. And it's that difference between just knowing something and even having a modicum of wisdom about it, but then truly understanding it. And you know that you have understanding because there's pardon the expression, but there's an ah factor involved in it. Where you come along and you say, ah, that's beyond just having some wisdom about it. But now I know when you, the awe factor is when you see its design intent. This is what it's designed to do. That awe is that perception where you now have perceived something as to more than just being wise things to say or do, but you see it within the framework of what it's designed and what it's capable of producing. And we're really running out of time, but so I'm trying to find a place to wind this up. I didn't get anywhere, really, but hopefully I haven't just spun my wheels off today. Maybe for some of you thinking, well, this is one class I could have missed, but the issue of perceiving is something that you need to really perceive and really understand as an advancement on knowing or being aware of something. We're not perceiving wisdom and instruction. We're perceiving the words of understanding. And just to again get back to this and kind of wind this all up properly here, to look at that word, the word perceive, you've got to realize that in all these two infinitives, it's that verb that is so critical to them all, to know, to receive, or to perceive, to receive, to give. Those are the critical issues that are going to determine how that the words of understanding are to be received, how to be they're to be taken in. And perceive, that little P-E-R in the word perceive is the Latin prefix that signifies something that's done thoroughly. And the most common definition has to do with a taking in or apprehending something with the mind and senses. It's a combination of the mind and senses to thoroughly apprehend with the mind and become conscious of it. Now, we can go through a lot of diction-type definitions, but what we're really going to have to do is look at something that can take us beyond that and see shades of meaning. And for that, you're going to need a good dictionary like Smith's Synonyms Discriminated. Mine is from 1822. Or no, not 18. It's 1862. Then Crabbe's. George Crabbe was one of the most brilliant men in English philology that took words and structured a system of synonyms, Crabbe's synonyms. The one I utilize is from 1830. And you really get some discriminating shades of meaning between these words. So, but just by what we've said in a definition type way alone, you realize there's advancement on this. You can, it's the difference between looking out your window. I was taking my dog for a ride yesterday, and my dog is a very unique animal when it comes to riding in a car. I've had dogs my whole life, and you could, I don't know what breed I got, if you had a window down, if you had a crack, I had a dog that tried to shove its head out the crack of a window, and tongue go out and the ears flopping. My dog, you can be in a convertible. Now, I've never been in one, but you could be in a convertible with my dog. My dog will sit dead center in the seat and look straight ahead. And then she'll check over and she'll cut over and look at me every once in a while, like, are you sure you know where you're going? And then when we stop, she'll take her nose and put it on my gear shift, like, go. She knows I grabbed that and we go. And she'll sit dead center. And I can't imagine what somebody behind us is like looking at us. It's like there's this guy and there's this dog that's, the wind is down, but it's not, you know, doing this and sticking its head out. It's like just sitting there like a little man or girl or something. And she does. She's just weird that way. I don't know. I didn't train her that way. But it's like having another companion. But she's not aware. I mean, she looks out the window and sees a lot of things, but she's not perceiving things. And when we get to this, and just to give you a taste of this, to get you thinking about it for next time on Tuesday, you may look at stars, for instance, and you see them. And actually, the word see is the very first synonymous term with the word perceive. In fact, the word know is not in the synonym list of perceive. Because perceive is something you do in combination with your mind and your senses. You have to see it first, but you can see it. You can see a lot of things like my dog and be absent-minded about it. You're not thinking about it. You're just looking. But perception is when your mind now not only do you see it, but now you have taken special notice of it. And that's the critical shade of difference in the word perceive. You have taken special notice of this. Like I say, you may see the stars at night and just be looking at them, but when you see a shooting star, you have to, that grabs your attention. You've taken special notice to see it move. And really, that's a problem, or can be potentially a problem, because this is really where the, and we'll deal with this, where you get this understanding of what it means to be absent-minded. You may be seeing and hearing with your senses, but you're not perceiving anything. It's like your body's here, but your mind is absent. And that is what, there's another English word that describes somebody like that. And it's the word ignorant. And what is the whole basis of the word ignorant? To ignore. Yeah. You're seeing it, but you're ignoring it. Perception, you can't ignore it. You've got to, it catches your attention and you focus it on it and you have noticed it. You've taken special notice. And what you're going to notice here are words that are designed to produce in you understanding. And there's a body of information in the book of Romans we just read that God has designed for you to perceive His words of understanding. You first of all know His wisdom and instruction, and then you perceive His words of understanding, and it's in those words that He's going to tell you something about His business and the grandeur of you being engaged in it. And that's to grab your attention, and you take special notice of that. So there's a lot of other things within those words of understanding as well. As I said, if you go through the rest of chapter 8, you'll see them as in our curriculum. Well, we'll stop right there. Beginning on Tuesday night, no review. We're going to jump right into the word to perceive, the words of understanding, and we're going to take that up and we're going to deal with that. By the way, this runs along the line of everything else that I teach and that I do. You know that, okay, if we've got a series of things we're going through, Mark's going to spend, where am I going to spend the most amount of my time? Right in the first of it. So the first couple things I'm going to spend the most amount of time. Then we'll go through what each one of these words, wisdom, justice, judgment, and equity means. And then another reason for that is because my understanding of level 1 is like this. My understanding of level 2 is like this. And my understanding of level 3 is real thin. And that's because I'm not a level 3 son. But I know where that information is contained in my curriculum. I know what books of Paul's letters that deals with. But I'm not there. So maybe that's some consolation. But anyway, we'll start on Tuesday night, perceiving the words of understanding, and nail that down with our